The Dancing Scouts. Erica's experience with art is a microcosm of all the different kinds of perception we have seen in this story. Seeing and hearing were thick, creative processes, not just a passive taking in. When you listen to a piece of music, for example, sound waves travel through the air at 1,100 feet per second and collide with your eardrums, setting off a chain of vibrations through the tiny bones of the ear against the membrane of the cochlea, producing tiny electrical charges that reverberate all across the brain. Maybe you don't know anything about music in the formal sense, but all your life, from the time when you were nursing in rhythm with your mother, you have been unconsciously constructing working models of how music works. You have been learning how to detect timed patterns and anticipate what will come next. Listening to music involves making a series of sophisticated calculations about the future. If the last few notes have had pattern Y, then the next few notes will probably have pattern Z. As Jonah Lehrer writes in his book, Proust Was a Neuroscientist, while human nature largely determines how we hear the notes, it is nurture that lets us hear the music. From the 3-minute pop song to the 5-hour Wagner opera, the creations of our culture teach us to expect certain musical patterns, which over time are wired into our brain. When the music conforms to our anticipations, we feel a soothing drip of pleasure. Some scientists believe that the more fluently a person can process a piece of information, the more pleasure it produces. When a song or a story or an argument achieves limerence with the internal models of the brain, then that synchronicity produces a warm swelling of happiness. But the mind also exists in a state of tension between familiarity and novelty. The brain has evolved to detect constant change and delights in comprehending the unexpected. So we are drawn to music that flirts with our expectations and then gently plays jokes on them. As Daniel Levitin observes in This Is Your Brain on Music, the first two notes of Over the Rainbow arrest our attention with the jarring octave gap between them, then the rest of the song eases us into a more conventional, soothing groove. In his book, Emotion and Meaning in Music, Leonard Meyer showed how Beethoven would establish a clear rhythmic and harmonic pattern and then manipulate it, never quite repeating it. Life is change, and the happy life is a series of gentle, stimulating, melodic changes. Perceiving a painting follows a similar process. First, the mind creates the painting. That is to say, each eye makes a series of fast, complex saccades across the surface of the picture, which then get blended and recreated inside the cortex, producing a single image. There are parts of each view the mind cannot see because of the blind spot in the middle of each eye where the optic nerve connects to the retina. The brain fills in the holes based on its own predictions. Simultaneously, the mind imposes its concepts upon the painting. For example, it imposes color. Depending on lighting and other factors, there are huge fluctuations in the wavelength energy of light bouncing off a painting, and yet the mind uses internal models to give the impression that the color on the surface is remaining constant. If the mind couldn't assign constant color to things, the world would be in chaotic flux, and it would be hard to deduce any useful information from the environment. How it creates this illusion of constant color is not well understood, but it seems to involve ratios. Imagine a green surface surrounded by yellows and blues and purples. The brain understands there is a constant ratio between the wavelengths bouncing off green and the wavelengths bouncing off yellow. It can assign constant qualities to each, even amidst changing conditions. As Chris Frith of the University College London has written, "Our perception of the world is a fantasy that coincides with reality." As it is creating the painting, the mind is also evaluating it. A wide body of research has found that there are certain tastes that most people share. As Dennis Dutton argues in The Art Instinct, people everywhere gravitate to a similar sort of painting. Landscapes with open spaces, water, roads, animals, and a few people. A cottage industry has grown up to investigate this preference. Evolutionary psychologists argue that people everywhere prefer paintings of landscapes that correspond to the African savanna, where humanity emerged. People generally don't like looking at dense vegetation, which is forbidding, or spare desert, which has no food. They like lush open grasses with thickets of trees and bushes, a water source, diversity of vegetation, including flowering and fruiting plants, and an unimpeded view of the horizon in at least one direction. Some critics have noted that Kenyans prefer pictures of the Hudson River School to pictures of their own native landscape. That's because, the critics argue, the landscape near the Hudson River in New York State more closely resembles the African savanna back in the Pleistocene era than does the present and much drier Kenya. More broadly, people like fractals, patterns that recur at greater levels of magnification. Nature is full of fractals, mountain ranges with peaks that gently echo one another, the leaves and branches on trees, a copse of aspens, rivers with their tributaries. People like the fractals that are gently flowing but not too complicated. Scientists even have a way to measure fractal density. Michael Gazzaniga illustrates the process in this example. Imagine that you were asked to draw a tree on a piece of paper. If you left the paper entirely blank, that would have a D, fractal density, of 1. If you drew a tree with so many branches, the paper was entirely black, that would have a D of 2. Humans generally prefer patterns with a fractal density of 1.3, some complexity, but not too much. Erica didn't have to think about fractals as she was looking at Vermeers or Van Eycks or Botticellis. That's the point. Her action was unconscious. She just stood there, savoring the pleasure. Creativity. After a while, Erica decided to create her own art. She tried photography and watercolors, but she found that she was unengaged and untalented. Then one day, she found a beautiful piece of wood, and she fashioned it into a small cutting board. Having it around the house and using it every day gave her immense satisfaction, and for the next few years, as long as her hands could perform the tasks, she made simple household items out of wood. She'd exercise in the pool in the morning and go for a walk, and then in the afternoons she would return to the little workshop she had built. Jean Cohen, founding chief of the Center on Aging at the National Institute of Mental Health, has argued that the duration of an activity is more important than the activity itself. In other words, a book club that meets on a regular basis over a course of months or years contributes a great deal more to a person's well-being than the same number of one-shot activities such as movies, lectures, or outings. As she continued to carve, Erica found that she was building a repertoire of knowledge and skills. She had to observe the wood she had in front of her. Not the generic concept of wood, but the specific piece. She had to divine what household item, napkin holder, a book stand, or even a piece of a table, lay in its grain. At first, she moved forward clumsily. But she'd walk through stores and crafts fairs, observing how craftsmen worked. She didn't like the whole authenticity atmosphere of the crafts movement, but she liked the objects themselves and how they fit together. As she observed and worked, she got better. She developed a set of hunches that guided her along, a repertoire of feels and gestures. She was astonished to find that she had her own style. She didn't know how she got it. She just fiddled around with things until they seemed right. Over and over again, Erica tried to do too much. This late in life, she still underestimated how long any project was likely to take her. But she found herself enjoyably dissatisfied by her work. She got a glimpse of some ideal thing she would want to create, and then she'd tinker and tinker with it, never quite eliminating the tension between the reality and the perfection she felt inside. But still she chased it. She understood what Marcel Proust might have been feeling when he dictated new passages of a novel from his deathbed. He wanted to change a section in which a character was dying, because now he knew how it really felt. The muses came and went. After working for a few hours, she felt her brain running dry, as if little carbonated bubbles in her brain had been used up and everything had gone flat. She became clumsy, lazy, and stale. Then, other times, she would awake in the middle of the night, absolutely sure of what she should do to solve a problem. The mathematician Henri Poincaré solved one of the most difficult problems of his life while stepping onto a bus. The answer just came to him. I went on with the conversation already commenced, but I felt a perfect certainty, he later wrote. Erica sometimes had little revelations like that, too, while she was parking the car or making a cup of tea. Like all artists and craftsmen, she was a plaything of the muses. Creativity seemed to happen in a hidden world beyond her control. The poet Amy Lowell wrote, "An idea will come into my head for no apparent reason. The bronze horses, for instance. I register the horses as a good subject for a poem, and, having so registered them, I consciously thought no more about the matter. But what I had really done was to drop my subject into the subconscious, much as one drops a letter into the mailbox. 6 months later, the words of the poem began to come into my head. The poem, to use my private vocabulary, was there." Erica learned little tricks to stoke the unreachable furnace. Art, as Wordsworth put it, is emotion recollected in tranquility. Erica had to put herself in a state in which her emotions bubbled to the surface. She had to go see a thrilling play, or climb a mountain, or read a tragedy. Then, her heart a tingle, she had to be relaxed enough to express the feelings welling up inside. As she had gotten older, she found she needed long periods of uninterrupted solitude for her conscious mind to slowly relax and surrender itself to the pulses generated inside. One interruption could ruin her mindset for an entire day. She found that this creative mindset was most likely to come late in the morning or early in the evening. She would work with her headphones on, playing soft classical music to loosen her thoughts. She needed to be near windows with a view of distant horizons. For some reason, she worked best in her dining room, which faced south, not in her studio. She also learned that when you are trying something new, it is best to do it quickly and wrong, and then go back and do it over and over again. And at rare and precious moments, she even got a sense of what athletes and artists must have meant when they talked about being in the flow. The narrative voice in her head went silent. She lost track of time. The tool seemed to guide her. She integrated with her task. What did she get out of all this? Did it improve her brain? Well, there is some evidence that children who participate in arts education experience a small IQ boost, just as there is some evidence that participating in music and drama classes seems to improve social skills. But these results are sketchy, and it is not true that just listening to Mozart or going to a museum will make you smarter. Did Erica's creativity help her live longer? A bit. There is substantial evidence to suggest that mental stimulation improves longevity. People with college degrees live longer than people without, even after controlling for other factors. Nuns with college degrees live longer, even though their lifestyles through adulthood are the same as nuns without them. People with larger vocabularies in adolescence are less likely to suffer dementia in old age. According to one California study, seniors who participate in arts programs require fewer doctor visits, use fewer medications, and generally experience better health than seniors who don't. But the real rewards were spiritual. It is said that people who go into therapy do it either because they need tightening, their behavior is too erratic, or because they need loosening, they are too repressed. Erica needed loosening, Reading poetry, visiting museums, and carving seemed to help her do it. As she relaxed, she became more patient, more of a wandering explorer. Summarizing a body of recent research, Malcolm Gladwell wrote that artists who succeed in their youth tend to be conceptual. Like Picasso, they start with a concept of what they want to achieve and then execute it. Those that thrive near the end of life tend to be exploratory. Like Cézanne, they don't start with clear conceptions, but go through a process of trial and error that eventually leads them to a destination. This is not always a passive, gentle process. In 1972, the great art historian Kenneth Clark wrote an essay on what he called the old age style. Looking across the arts, and especially at Michelangelo, Titian, Rembrandt, Donatello, Turner, and Cézanne, he believed he could detect a common pattern that many great elderly artists shared. A sense of isolation, a feeling of holy rage, developing into what I have called transcendental pessimism, a mistrust of reason, a belief in instinct. If we consider old age art from a more narrowly stylistic point of view, we find a retreat from realism, an impatience with established technique, and a craving for complete unity of treatment, as if the picture were an organism in which every member shared in the life of the whole. Erica obviously did not have these masters' genius, nor their inner turbulence. But she did have a desire to push hard through her final years and create surprises for herself. Erica found that the arts gave her access to her deeper regions. Artists take the sentiments that are buried in inchoate form across many minds and bring them to the surface for all to see. They express the collective emotional wisdom of the race. They keep alive and transmit states of mind from one generation to the next. We pass on culture, therefore, Roger Scruton has written, as we pass on science and skill, not to benefit the individual, but to benefit our kind, by conserving a form of knowledge that would otherwise vanish from the world. You are there. One summer, a couple of years after retirement, Harold and Erica took the best vacation of their lives. They traveled around France looking at cathedrals. Harold prepared for the trip for a few months, reading up on cathedral construction and medieval history, just as he had back at school. He put different passages of the books he was reading on his computer tablet to take with him, and he planned an itinerary and outlined a narration for their entire voyage. His narration would be just like the old presentations he used to give at work, except this time he'd be talking about architecture and chivalry, and they'd be walking through towns and churches as he spoke. Harold didn't spend a lot of time memorizing the names of the kings and the processions of battles. He operated under the assumption that each group and each age inadvertently produced their own symbolic system. Buildings, organizations, teachings, practices, and stories. And then people live within the moral and intellectual structure of those symbols without really thinking about it. So when Harold talked about medieval life, he was just trying to capture what it felt like to be the sort of person who lived at that time. As he put it, he wasn't describing the fish, he was describing the water they swam in. Harold loved this sort of educational travel. He could touch and feel the past, the darkness of an old building in daytime, the mildew of a castle keep, the glimpse of a forest through the slit of a castle lookout. With these prompts flooding his mind, he could imaginatively enter into other ages. They traveled through Caen and Reims and Chartres. They'd walked side by side, Harold whispering information from the books he had read, speaking as much for his own pleasure as for hers. Life was more extreme then, he said at one point. There were extremes of summer heat and winter cold, with few conveniences to temper them. There were extremes of light and darkness, health and sickness. Political boundaries were arbitrary and changed with the death of a king or lord. Government was hodgepodge, with different mixtures of custom and Roman and church law. One year could produce plenty and the next famine. And it was possible to walk from one town, where times were good, to another where people were starving. One in three people were under 14, and the life expectancy was 40. So there was no great throng of people in their 40s, 50s, or 60s to sort of calm things down. As a result, their life was more emotionally intense than ours is today. On festival days, they celebrated with a drunken joy that we scarcely seem to know. On the other hand, they could succumb to mind-grabbing terror that we can only remember from childhood. They were capable of enjoying tender love stories one moment, and then cheering as a beggar was dismembered the next. Their perception of tears and suffering and color itself seems to have been more vivid. There were certain modulating ideas that we take for granted that they did not have in their mental toolbox. They didn't have a concept for diminished capacity, the idea that a mentally disabled person might not be fully responsible for his actions. They didn't have a concept for judicial fallibility, or for the idea that criminals should be rehabilitated instead of simply being made to suffer. For them, it was all extremes, guilt or innocence, salvation or damnation. Harold and Derica were walking through the village of Chartres as he said this, and crossing toward the cathedral. They walked across a square with coffee shops, and Harold described how the medieval Frenchmen of the 12th century lived in squalor and filth, and yet yearned for an ideal world. They constructed elaborate codes of chivalry and courtly love. He described the intricate rules of courtesy that governed everyday court life, the profusion of rituals, the many organizations that required oaths and other sacred rites, the stately procession in which each participant in the social order had his or her own socially approved fabric, color scheme, and place. It was almost as if they were putting on a play for themselves. It was almost as if they were turning their short, squalid lives into a dream, Harold continued. He said that tournaments were supposed to be stylized, though in reality they were often shambolic brawls. Love was supposed to be stylized, though often it was just brutal rape. In imagination, everything was turned into a mythical ideal version of itself, though in reality there was degradation and stench all around. They had a great yearning for beauty, and a great faith in God and the ideal world. And somehow that great faith produced this, Harold said, gesturing up at the Chartres Cathedral. He described how nobles and peasants would volunteer their labor to build the great church, how whole villages would move close to the cathedral towns so they could help create these great edifices soaring above the normal hovels of wood and grass. He described the intricate recurring patterns of tracery, the recursive rhythm of arches, the countless replicating folds of stone, each reflecting and magnifying the last. They spent an hour before the west front, tracing the symbols of the Trinity carved into the central door, the way Christ's body is connected to the signs of the zodiac and the labors of the month on the ascension door. As much as he could, Harold described the great bombardment of symbols and meaning that would have rained down on the illiterate pilgrims, setting off strings of associations and awe in their minds. Inside, he described the revolutionary splendor of the design. Through most of history until the 12th century, men had constructed buildings to be heavy and formidable. Now, here, they constructed buildings to be light and weightless. They used stones to create a feeling for the spiritual. Man may rise to the contemplation of the divine through the senses, Abbot Suger wrote. Harold loved teaching. He loved being a tour guide more than anything he had ever done. On odd occasions, talking about this or that historical scene, he'd find himself strangely moved. People in centuries past, he came to believe, devoted more energy to the sacred. They spent more time building sacred spaces and practicing sacred rituals. They built gateways to a purer mode of existence. Harold was drawn to these ancient places and gateways, to ruins, cathedrals, palaces, and holy grounds, more than to any modern place or living city. In Europe, especially, He divided cities between those that were living, like Frankfurt, and those that were dead, like Bruges and Venice. He liked the dead cities best. After an hour or so inside the cathedral, Harold and Erica left and began walking back to dinner. As they did, they passed the west portals and saw a range of statues arrayed about the doorways. Harold knew nothing about them. They were church elders of some sort, or maybe donors, or scholars, or heroes from the ancient past. Erica paused unexpectedly to look at them. Their bodies were elongated cylinders with gracefully carved draping robes. Their gestures mimicked one another, one hand down around the waist and the other clutching something by the neck. But it was the faces that caught Harold's attention. Some of the statues they had seen on the trip were generic and impersonal. The artists had tried to symbolize a person's face rather than represent a particular one. But these sculptures depicted real people, idiosyncratic and ensouled. Their faces held different expressions of selflessness, detachment, patience, and acquiescence. They were the product of a specific set of personal experiences and reflected a unique set of hopes and ideals. Though he was tired after a long day, Harold actually experienced a chill looking into those faces and eyes. He had the sensation that they saw him, that they sympathized with him and gazed at him, gazing at them. Historians sometimes speak of moments of historical ecstasy, the feeling that magically comes over them when the distance of the centuries disappears, and they have the astonishing sensation of direct contact with the past. Harold felt something like that now, and Erica could see a glow on his cheeks. It was a wonderful day, and an exhausting one. At nightfall, they went to a restaurant and had a long, happy meal. Erica was struck by how enchanted the world seemed to people in the Middle Ages. For us, the night sky is filled with distant balls of fire and vast empty space. But for them, it was alive with creatures and magic. The stones of the church and the trees in the woods resonated with spirits, ghosts, and divine presences. The cathedrals were not just buildings. They were like spiritual powerhouses, places where heaven and earth met. People back then seemed voracious for mythology, she observed. They blended Greek, Roman, Christian, and pagan myths together, regardless of internal logic, and made everything alive. Even the bones of saints had magical powers. It was as if every material thing was crystallized with a spiritual presence. Every aesthetic thing was also a sacred thing. Our world seems disenchanted in comparison, she thought with a sigh. Harold mentioned how much fun he was having. Somehow knowledge only came alive to him when he was teaching it to somebody, and at the end he mused that maybe he'd missed his calling as a tour guide. Erica gave him an energized look. Would you like to be? That night they hatched a plan. Harold would lead tours for small groups of cultivated travelers. Maybe they'd conduct 3 a year. He'd study a period for a few months, just as he had with the Middle Ages, and then take a group to France or Turkey or the Holy Land. They'd contract with a tour company, so they wouldn't have to worry too much about the travel arrangements. Erica could run the rest of the operation. It would be their post-retirement small business. Erica figured they could compete with the alumni groups that run these sort of tours, because theirs would be more intimate. They'd rely mostly on friends, so the travelers would pretty much know one another before they signed up. And that's pretty much what happened for the next 8 years. They created a company called You Are There Tours, which was like a traveling course in human civilization, with nice hotels and wine. They'd be at home for a few months, and Harold would bury himself in his books, preparing. And then they'd take 2 weeks off with a group, getting an all-expenses-paid educational vacation in Greece or some other spot on the itinerary of human accomplishment. Harold loved it. For Harold, the preparation for the trips was actually better than the trips themselves. 3 times a year, Erica got to experience intense bursts of learning. When she was on those trips, time would slow down. She'd notice a thousand novel things. It was like feeling the pores of her skin open. Erica never got to the point in her life when she could really relax. She always had to be moving and doing and achieving. But this was a delicious sort of exertion. For someone who'd spent her life struggling and climbing, these trips were pure joy. Chapter 22. Meaning. It's hard to know when the immortals started appearing on the mountains. You'd be hiking or biking or cross-country skiing outside of Aspen, Colorado, and from behind, you'd hear this whoosh that sounded like an incoming F-18. You'd turn around and see this little nugget of spandex. It was one of those super-fit old guys who'd decided to go on a fitness jihad in retirement. He'd shrunk as he crossed age 70. So he'd be 4'10 and 95 pounds of hard gristle wrapped in spandex action gear. He'd be coming at you at ferocious speed, wearing weights on his wrists and ankles, and a look of fierce determination on his small, wrinkled face. You'd be huffing and puffing on the mountainside, and this super buff spandex senior would whiz by like a little iron raisinette. These old guys had succeeded at everything else they had ever tried, so they had simply decided to say a big fuck you to death. Earlier in life, they had been the sort of ambitious young strivers who had started their first paper route at 6, made their first million by 22, and they'd married a string of beauties so that they had achieved this weird genetic phenomenon in which their grandmothers looked like Gertrude Stein, but their granddaughters looked like Uma Thurman. In their post-retirement quest for eternal youth, they'd hired personal trainers, graduated from fitness boot camps, and spent much of their time at their resort homes strategizing about energy shakes, veggie-centric cuisine, and bone marrow preservation. They could be counted upon to take up windsurfing at 70 and K2 expeditions at 75. And by 90, they'd be popping Cialis like breath mints and working out so furiously their fitness trainers would be dropping with coronaries just trying to keep up. They had the time and means and focus to do all this because they'd entered their Pluto adolescence. When highly ambitious men make a lot of money and then retire to high-end vacation communities, they enter a phase of life in which they have the money, the time, and the mentality to make a profession out of all the puerile stuff they enjoyed at age 18. They don't actually have the energy levels they used to, but for brief bursts, they are raging libidos with platinum Amex cards. They hang out with resort town celebrities, George Hamilton, Kevin Costner, and Jimmy Buffett. They unsuccessfully flirt with young waitresses, then go home to the event planners they married as trophy wives a few decades ago, and who have now, in their 50s, turned into modern American centaurs. Because cosmetic surgeons are apparently more proficient the lower down the body you get, these women have legs like Serena Williams, but overstretched G-force cheeks and the stuffed pillow lips. It's become fashionable to be interested in education, so many of these guys have 3 homes, 6 cars, 4 mistresses, and 5 charter schools. They also spend a lot of time bonding with one another. If you go to a resort community from Bridgehampton to Aspen to Malibu, you can see packs of these overly fit oldsters meeting on the sidewalk in the early evening on their way to a tapas restaurant. None of them really wants to go to the tapas restaurant, which is filled with dishes they don't understand, but they are in the grip of some primordial new urbanist force, and as modern cosmopolitan sophisticates, they are sentenced to endless tapas ordeals. They and everybody in their party will be condemned to spend 90 minutes wrestling with traditional date fritters, squid with aioli, saffron rice with cuttlefish, and grilled peppers straight from the Canary Islands, which they neither look forward to nor savor, but which they must simply endure as one of the mysteries of their civilization. As they walk that long gray mile to the tapas of doom, The group will radiate a certain sort of male giddiness, and a strange transformation will take place. For it is a law of human nature that the more men you concentrate in one happy pack, the more each of them will come to resemble Donald Trump. They possess a sort of masculine photosynthesis to start with, the ability to turn sunlight into self-admiration. By the law of compound egotism, they create this self-reinforcing vortex of smugness which brings out the most pleased with themselves aspects of their own personalities. These men are, in other circumstances, loving grandfathers, eager to talk about their offspring at Stanford, who are in year abroad programs in Cambodia. But when sucked into the psychodynamics of an haute bourgeois boy gang, striding around sockless in their performance sandals, they become immature versions of themselves. Their decibels rise. Their chests puff. Their laughs explode. They become temporary geriatric gangsters and brag and swagger in a spirit of rising male hysteria. They get a form of millionaire Titan Alzheimer's. They forget everything but their erections. The contemplative life. After they retired, Erica and Harold bought a second home in Aspen, where they lived during the summer and for a few weeks around Christmas. They saw the immortals swooshing by and carousing when they went downtown, but their own lives had taken a different path. They had also achieved what is called success, but theirs was a different kind of success. Without really thinking about it, they had created a counterculture. They didn't consciously reject the lifestyle of the affluent mainstream. They just sort of ignored it. They lived and thought differently, and their lives had taken on a different and deeper shape. They had a greater awareness of the wellsprings of the human heart, and when you met them, you were impressed by their substance and depth. On summer afternoons, they'd sit in Adirondack chairs on the front porch and look out over the roaring Fork River and wave at the occasional raft trip going by. Harold would read his serious nonfiction books, and Erica would read novels and nap. Harold would look over at her as she slept. Her Chinese features had become more pronounced as she had gotten older, and she was thinner and smaller. Harold would remember a story he had once read by Mark Saltzman. It was about a man in China who was learning English. One day, his teacher asked him what had been the happiest moment of his life. The Chinese man paused for a long time, and then he smiled with embarrassment and said that once his wife had gone to Beijing and eaten duck, and she often told him about the delicious duck. And so, the story concluded, he would have to say the happiest moment in his life was her trip and the eating of the duck. Harold would think back on his own life and then try to squeeze it into the shape of that story. And he would remember a blue shirt Erica had earned in high school for making the honor roll, which had made her so proud, and which she would talk about when she welcomed young interns to their firm, or when she was invited to speak at a company or college commencement. He had heard her tell the story of the shirt hundreds of times over the years, first when she was young and starting out in life, when she told it to him over dinner, then when she was confident and middle-aged and being interviewed and feted, and now when she was older and smaller and wrinkled. He reflected that it wouldn't be totally inaccurate for him to say that the happiest moment of his life had been her making the honor roll before she knew him, and the earning of the shirt. On those afternoons they would talk about things, sometimes over a glass of wine, or two or three for Harold. In the late afternoons Erica would rise and get Harold a sweater, and then she'd go in to cook them an early dinner. Harold would sit there watching the shadows of the evening sun. They had run their tour company for about 8 years, but eventually they had to give it up. Harold's knees had begun to go, then his hips and his ankles, which had been prone to tendonitis all his life. He was largely immobile now, walking awkwardly and slowly with two canes. He would never play tennis again, never golf again, never carelessly get up and walk across the room again. His body was breaking down. He'd been in the hospital nearly once a year for the past few years, for one thing or another. Some men grow thin and frail as they age, but he, immobile, grew heavy and round. For the first few years of his old age, he found he needed more and more help for little chores he'd never given a second thought to all his life, sometimes to even get out of bed or a chair. Erica would grab his hands and then lean back like a sailor leaning against the pull of the sail and leverage him up. Then, as the decay worsened, he needed help all the time. Harold was imprisoned in his chair. He endured 3 bouts of depression as he realized he would no longer be a participant in the life of the planet, but just a decaying observer of it. For several months he lay awake at night in a sort of madness, imagining the horrors to come, surgeons opening his chest, his throat gorging with blood and choking off his air supply, losing speech and pieces of his mind, losing limbs, sight, and hearing. He could no longer participate in parties and social occasions. He just sat against the wall. On the other hand, his wife and his nurses served him with a care, patience, and devotion that surpassed all expectation. Their efforts were more dear to him because he knew that he could never repay them. He had to surrender his male pride, his egoism, his sense of self-mastery, and depend utterly upon their service and affection. It was hard at first to simply fall backward into their love. At first their attention made him cranky and cross, but their patient love soothed him. Eventually his physical condition stabilized, and his moods lifted. He'd sit on his porch, and he could look out at the elementals of nature. Sky, mountains, trees, water, and sun. Researchers have found, not surprisingly, that sunlight and natural scenes can have a profound effect on mind and mood. People in northern latitudes, where the sunlight is less bright, have higher rates of depression than people in lower latitudes. So do people on the western edges of time zones, where the sun rises later in the mornings. People who have spent much of their lives working the night shift have higher chances of suffering breast cancer than those who work in the day. Researchers have found that hospital patients in rooms with natural views seem to recover slightly faster than patients in rooms without them. In a study done in Milan, patients with bipolar depression who stayed in east-facing hospital rooms were discharged 3.5 days sooner than patients housed in west-facing ones. Harold found he could play a little game with himself. He'd sit on the porch looking at a little flower in the grass down below. He'd concentrate on the petals and their fragile beauty. Then, by lifting his head, he'd gaze out at the icy mountain peaks miles and miles away. Suddenly, he was swept up in an entirely different set of sensations. Feelings of awe, veneration, submission, and greatness. Just sitting there, he could move from the beautiful to the sublime and back again. He loved these grand views. They gave him a feeling of elevation, of being connected to a sacred and all-encompassing order, a part of some stupendous whole. People who are out in nature do better on tests of working memory and attention than people who are in urban settings. Their moods are better. As the philosopher Charles Taylor writes, "Nature draws us because it is in some way attuned to our feelings, so that it can reflect and intensify those we already feel, or else awaken those which are dormant. Nature is like a great keyboard on which our highest sentiments are played out. We turn to it as we might turn to music, to evoke and strengthen the best in us." The views of the mountains and trees soothed him and enlivened him, but they didn't really satisfy him. As others have noted, nature is a preparation for religion, but it is not religion. Harold was still in pain much of the time. During those horrendous hours, pain filled his mind the way a gas fills the available space in a container. He could barely remember what it was like to not be in pain. Yet when it was gone, He couldn't remember the pain itself. He just had a cold, intellectual concept of it. Most of the time, Harold thought about people. He'd remember quick visual images, a playmate and her toy car sitting in the snow, his parents taking him to look at a new house, an office mate on a terrible day, washing his red face over a sink in the restroom. But there were mysterious gaps in his memory, too. He found he could not recall ever sitting around the dinner table with his parents, though it must have happened all the time. Harold found that his memories came in strings. He remembered a catch he made playing dodgeball in fourth grade. This set him thinking about his teacher that year, who he had a crush on. He felt her presence but couldn't really make out her face. She had long, dark hair. She was tall, or seemed so. Nothing else was distinct but the aura of her beauty and sweetness and his feelings for her at the time. Harold would ask Erica to bring him boxes of their old stuff, photographs, papers, and documents that they kept hodgepodge from decades past. Then he'd rummage around in the boxes. Even while younger, he'd had the presence of mind to save only the happy reminders, and so the bad times faded away. He was slightly deranged while rummaging through these old things, or drunk, for he was back to drinking during the day. Emotions and feelings streamed through him. He found he could remember old poems in their entirety. He had images of Olympics and elections and national events coursing through his head. He could relive the atmosphere of a decade, the way people wore their hair, the kinds of jokes they told. He would sit there, giddily playing with time. Psychologists have a term for seniors who have trouble inhibiting their thoughts and whose conversations veer off in random directions. They call it off-topic verbosity. Harold suffered from that sort of malady, except it was going on inside. One second he'd remember body surfing in the waves as a boy, and the next, a drive he took last week. There's an old fable about a monk who went for a walk in the woods and paused to listen to the lovely trilling of a small bird. When he returned to his monastery, he found nothing but strangers there. He had been gone 50 years. Some afternoons, Harold felt that his personal time scale had slipped its gears. Harold felt rejuvenated by his memories. In 1979, the psychologist Ellen Langer conducted an experiment in which she equipped an old monastery in Peterborough, New Hampshire, with props from the 1950s. She invited men in their 70s and 80s to stay for a week. They watched old Ed Sullivan shows, listened to Nat King Cole on the radio, and talked about the 1959 championship game between the Baltimore Colts and the New York Giants. At the end of the week, the men had gained an average of 3 pounds and looked younger. They tested better on hearing and memory. Their joints were more flexible, and 63% did better on an intelligence test. Experiments like that are more suggestive than scientific, but Harold felt better when he was living back in the past. The pains diminished, the joys increased. Search for meaning. Harold spent a lot of time thinking about his teenage years when he was about 16. This is the period researchers call the reminiscence bump, because memories from late adolescence to early adulthood tend to be more vivid than those from any other time of life. He wondered how accurate his memories could possibly be. When George Valent from the Grant Longitudinal Study sent an elderly subject reports on his early life for fact-checking purposes, he sent back the reports insisting, "You must have sent these to the wrong person." He simply could not remember any of the events from his own life that had been recorded at the time. The subject of another longitudinal study had suffered a brutal childhood at the hands of abusive parents, well documented at the time. But at age 70, he remembered his father as a good family man and his mother as the kindest woman in the world. Harold also experienced a sort of negative enjoyment. After a lifetime spent preparing for things and building for things, he was finally free from the burden of the future. How pleasant is the day, William James once observed, when we give up striving to be young or slender. Even though old and dying, Harold was plagued by an intellectual discontent. Without even thinking about it, he, like most of us, regarded life not only as a set of events to be experienced, but as a question to be answered. What is it all for? Sitting there on that porch with his canes propped against the chair, Harold set out, in the twilight of his life, to understand the meaning of his existence, to bring it all to a point. In his famous book, Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl writes, "Man's search for meaning is the primary motivation in his life." He quotes Nietzsche's words, "He who has a why to live for can bear with almost any how." But then Frankl made a crucial, helpful point. It's fruitless to try to think in the abstract about what life in general means. The meaning of one's life is only discernible within the specific circumstances of one's own specific life. In the concentration camp, he writes, "We had to learn ourselves, and furthermore, we had to teach the despairing men that it did not really matter what we expected from life, but rather what life expected from us." We needed to stop asking the meaning of life and instead to think of ourselves as those who were being questioned by life daily and hourly. Our answer must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and right conduct. Harold thought back on his life as a son, a husband, a business consultant, and a historian, and wondered what question life had asked of him. He looked for something that could be defined as his life's calling or mission. He thought the project would be easy, but the more he looked for a key to his life, the harder it was to find. When studied honestly and accurately, his life had been a series of fragmented events. Sometimes he had been very money-oriented, but other times he was oblivious to money. Sometimes he had been ambitious, but in other phases he was not. During some years he wore the mask of a scholar, while at others he wore the mask of a businessman. And who was the true self beneath the masks? In The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life, Irving Goffman argues that it's masks all the way down. Scientists and writers have tried to impose certain schema to describe how life evolves. Abraham Maslow defined his hierarchy of needs, from the physical to safety, love, esteem, and self-actualization. But much recent research has cast doubt on the idea that human lives fall into such neat schemas. There are no simple progressions of the sort Maslow described. Some days Harold felt defeated and concluded that life is unknowable. Take something as simple as buying a car. Did he choose his last car because of the shape of the body, the write-up in Consumer Reports, some vague image he had of the brand personality, how it felt in the test drive, some sense of the status it would give him, or maybe because of the dealer discount? All of those things must have played a role, but he couldn't really define the proportions. There was a murky twilight zone between the factors that must have gone into his choice and the actual choice as it had emerged at the dealership. We can never, even by the strictest examination, get completely behind the secret springs of action, Immanuel Kant had written. And if that is true of buying a car, how much more true must it be about pursuing the grand goals of a life? If Harold had a true understanding of himself, he would be able to predict what he would want from life in a year. But he had no confidence he could do that, or even in a month. If Harold had a true understanding of himself, he would be able to describe certain qualities he possessed, but he had no confidence he could do that reliably either. People vastly overrate and misapprehend their abilities. Numerous studies have shown that there is low correlation between how people rate their own personality and how people around them rate it. Harold would sit there, trying to think about himself. But in seconds he found he was thinking about people he had known or things he had experienced. Sometimes he'd think about some project he'd done at work, or a fight he had had with a co-worker. He had a sense of himself as a coherent presence in these dramas, but when he tried to think of himself in isolation, what he was and what he lived for, he could conjure up no clear concept in his mind. It was as if he were an optical illusion, visible when you weren't looking straight at it, but invisible when you made it the object of your attention. Some of his friends had off-the-shelf narratives to tell about themselves. One was a poor boy who had risen from rags to riches. Another was a sinner who had been saved in an instant by God. Another had changed his mind about everything in the course of his life. He had started in the forest of error and emerged into the light of truth. In his book, The Redemptive Self, Dan McAdams writes that Americans are especially prone to organize their lives into stories of redemption. Once upon a time, they had strayed on the path of tribulation, but then they met a mentor or found a wife or went to work at a foundation or did some other thing, and they were redeemed. They were delivered from error and put onto a proper path. Their life had purpose from that moment forth. As he reviewed his own life, Harold couldn't see how his life fit into any of those narrative molds. And as this process of self-analysis went on, Harold grew intensely sad, plagued by the sense that there was an ultimate deadline he would not meet. Some psychologists urge patients to sit in a chair and look inside themselves, but there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that this sort of rumination is often harmful. When people are depressed, they pick out the negative events and emotions of their lives, and, by fixing attention upon them, they make those neural networks stronger and more dominant. In his book, Strangers to Ourselves, Timothy Wilson of the University of Virginia summarizes several experiments in which rumination made depressed people more depressed, while distraction made them less depressed. Ruminators fell into self-defeating, negative patterns of thought, did worse in problem-solving tasks, and had much gloomier predictions about their own future. At times, the whole self-examination exercise seemed futile to Harold. How pathetically scanty my self-knowledge is compared with, say, my knowledge of my room, Franz Kafka once observed. There is no such thing as observation of the inner world as there is of the outer world. The Final Day. One afternoon in late summer, Harold was out on the porch of the Aspen house watching the river go by. He could hear Erica in her office upstairs tapping away at her keyboard. He had a scratched metal box on his lap, and he was leafing through some papers and photographs. He came across a picture of himself from long ago. He was about 6 when the photo was taken. He was wearing a navy-style peacoat, and he was atop a metal playground slide, about to come down, looking with intense concentration on the chute below. "What do I have in common with that boy?" Harold asked himself. Nothing, except that it was himself. The knowledge, the circumstances, the experience, and the appearance were all different, but there was something alive in that boy that was still alive within him now. There was a certain essence that had changed as he had aged, but without fundamentally becoming something other than itself. And that essence, Harold chose to call his soul. He supposed that this essence was manifested in neurons and synapses. He had been born with certain connections, and since the brain is the record of the feelings of a life, he had slowly accreted new neural connections in his head. And yet Harold couldn't help but think how enchanted it all was. The connections had been formed by emotion. The brain was physical meat, but out of the billions of energy pulses emerged spirit and soul. There must be some supreme creative energy, he thought, that can take love and turn it into synapses, and then take a population of synapses and turn it into love. The hand of God must be there. Harold looked at the little boy's hands clutching the railing of the slide and the expression on the little boy's face. Harold didn't have to imagine what the boy's affections and fears were, because at some level he could still experience them directly. He didn't have to reconstruct the manner in which that boy saw the world, because it was still, at some level, his own manner. That little boy was afraid of heights. That little boy felt light-headed at the sight of blood. That little boy was in love, but often felt alone. That little boy already possessed a hidden kingdom, a cast of characters and responses that would grow, mature, assert themselves, recede and regress at different times of his life. That hidden kingdom was he, then as now. Part of that kingdom grew out of his relationships with his parents. They weren't the most profound people ever. They spent too much time in the world of commerce, focusing on appearances and vanities. They could never really answer his deepest needs, but they had been good people who loved him. One of them had probably taken him to this playground and stood behind the camera to take this picture, and had filed it away somewhere so Harold could see it now. There'd been an emotion when the picture was taken, and an emotion when it was filed away, and there was an emotion when Harold looked at it now and imagined his mom or dad behind the camera, pushing the button. The loops still reverberated across the decades from generation to generation. The soul emerged from these loops of affection. The loops were momentary and fragile, also permanent and enduring. Even today, there were little sleeper cells lodged in his mind, affections and fears planted long ago which could lie dormant for decades and then suddenly spring to life in the right circumstances. The way his parents reacted to his small accomplishments, that delicious feeling, motivated him his whole life. The way his working-class grandparents never felt truly accepted in middle-class America, as if their presence was contingent and peripheral, that insecurity lingered in him his whole life. The way his friends in school draped their arms around his shoulder and leaned against him in the cafeteria, that feeling of comradeship that strengthened him until his dying day. Social connections early in life predict longevity and good health at the end. Harold tried and failed to see into the tangle of connections, the unconscious region, which he came to think of as the Big Shaggy. The only proper attitude toward this region was wonder, gratitude, awe, and humility. Some people think they are the dictators of their own life. Some believe the self is an inert wooden ship to be steered by a captain at the helm. But Harold had come to see that his conscious self, the voice in his head, was more a servant than a master. It emerged from the hidden kingdom and existed to nourish, edit, restrain, attend, refine, and deepen the soul within. For all his life until this period, he had wondered how his life would turn out. But now the story was complete. He knew his fate. He was relieved from the burden of the future. The cold fear of death was there in his mind, but so was the knowledge that he'd been extraordinarily lucky. He stepped back and asked some questions of himself, assessments of the life he had lived. And each question generated its own instant feeling, so he didn't even have to put the answer into words. Had he deepened himself? In a culture of instant communication, in which it was so easy to live superficially, had he spent time on the important things, developing his most consequential talents? This question felt good to ask, because while he had never become a prophet or sage, he had read the serious books, engaged the serious questions, and had tried, as best he could, to cultivate a luxuriant inner realm. Had he contributed to the river of knowledge, left a legacy for future generations? This question he could not feel so good about. He had tried to discover new things. He had written essays and delivered lectures. But he had been an observer more than an actor. For too many years he had drifted, flitting from one interest to another. At other times he had held back, unwilling to take the risks and suffer the blows that come from living in the arena. He had not done all that he might have to offer gifts to those who would live on. Had he transcended this earthly realm? No. He always had a sense there was something beyond life as science understands it. He had always somehow believed in a God who existed beyond time and space. But he had never fallen in with religion. He had lived a worldly life and, regretfully, had never tasted divine transcendence. Had he loved? Yes. The one constant in his adult life had been his admiration and love for the good woman who was his wife. He knew that she did not reciprocate his love with the same strength and devotion. He knew that she had overshadowed him, and their life paths had followed her achievements. He knew that she had sometimes lost interest in him, and there had been lonely years in the middle of their marriage. But that didn't matter to him now. In the end, his ability to be with her and to sacrifice himself for her had been another of life's gifts. And now, in his vulnerable final years, she was offering back everything that he had given. Even if they had been married only this month, with him immobile and her caring for him in a thousand ways, life would still have been worth living. As the hours ahead had shortened, his love for her had only grown. Just then, Erica came out onto the porch and asked him if he wanted some dinner brought out. "Oh, is it dinner time already?" he asked. She said it was, and there was some cold chicken in the fridge she could bring out with some potato chips. She went back inside, and Harold was left to go back to his reverie. And as he reviewed different scenes from his life, the questions life asked of him, and his assessments of them, dissolved, and he was left with just sensations. It was like being in a concert or a movie. His sense of self faded away. It was like the way he had been in his room as a boy, moving trucks around while lost in some great adventure. Erica came back out onto the porch and dropped the tray she was carrying and screamed and rushed over to Harold and grabbed his hand. His body had sagged and was inert. His head was on his chin and drool was coming out of his mouth. She looked into his eyes, the eyes she had grown accustomed to looking into all these decades, and she could see no reaction there, though he was breathing. She made a move to run to the phone, but Harold's hand tightened around hers. She sat back down, looking him in the face, and weeping. Harold had lost consciousness, but not life. Images flowed into his head the way they do in the seconds before one falls asleep. They came in a chaotic succession. In his unself-consciousness, he didn't regard them the way he would have at an earlier time. He regarded them in a way that was beyond words. We would say he regarded them holistically, somehow feeling everything at once. We would say he participated in them impressionistically, rather than analytically. He felt presences. As I put them down on this page, I have to put them in one sentence after another, but this is not how Harold experienced them. There were images of the paths he used to ride his bike on as a boy, and the mountains he looked out upon that day. There he was, doing homework with his mother, and also tackling a running back in high school. There were speeches he had made, compliments he had received, sex he had had, books he had read, and moments when some new idea had broken over him like a wave. For a few moments, consciousness seemed about to flicker back. He could sense Erica weeping out there, and compassion enveloped him. Inside, the swirls in his mind were still interlooping with hers. They were shared swirls that leapt across from her conscious world to his unconscious one. Categories fell away. Tenderness was out of control. His ability to focus attention ended, and at the same time his ability to interpenetrate the souls of others increased. His relation to her at this moment was direct. There were no analytics, no reservations, no ambitions, no future desires or past difficulties. It was just I and thou, a unity of being, a higher state of knowledge, a merger of souls. At this point, his questions about the meaning of life were no longer asked, but were answered. Harold entered the hidden kingdom entirely, and then lost consciousness forever. In his last moments, there were neither boundaries nor features. He was unable to wield the power of self-consciousness, but also freed from its shackles. He had been blessed with consciousness so that he might help direct his own life and nurture his inner life, but the cost of that consciousness was an awareness that he would die. Now he lost that awareness. He was past noticing anything now, and had entered the realm of the unutterable. It would be interesting to know if this meant he had also entered a kingdom of heaven, God's kingdom, but that was not communicated back to Erica. His heart continued to beat for a few minutes, and his lungs filled and emptied with air, and electrochemical impulses still surged through his brain. He made some gestures and twitches, which the doctors would call involuntary, but which, in this case, were more deeply felt than any other gesture could be. And one of them was a long squeeze of the hand, which Erica took to mean goodbye. What had been there at the start was there at the end. The tangle of sensations, perceptions, drives, and needs that we call, antiseptically, the unconscious. This tangle was not the lower part of Harold. It was not some secondary feature to be surpassed. It was the core of him, hard to see, impossible to understand, but supreme. Harold had achieved an important thing in his life. He had constructed a viewpoint. Other people see life primarily as a chess match played by reasoning machines. Harold saw life as a never-ending interpenetration of souls. This is Arthur Morey. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Social Animal: The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement, by David Brooks. This program was directed by Tony Huds. Executive producers, Kelly Gilday and Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2011 by David Brooks. Production copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.